This is the Education Gadfly Show.
John, is this where online learning is going to?
You mean to crash and burn on the stock market?
Yes.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, the Mark Zuckerberg of the education policy world, John Chubb.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
That's probably, I'm not even sure what that means, the Zuck reference there. But of course, fun to see the Facebook did not live up to its hype this week. John, is this where online learning is going to?
You mean to crash and burn on the stock market?
Yes. A big bubble, all a bunch of hot air.
Well, we could only wish there were a bubble. The progress has been painfully slow on the K-12 side, not so much on higher education. But if we can get into it, there are signs that it may be taking off. So,
yeah. Are you on Facebook, John?
I am on Facebook. I am not a regular Facebooker, but I get
Yeah. Have you ever clicked on a Facebook ad?
I have never clicked on a Facebook ad. Usually, I'm clicking on things that my kids tag me on.
Yes,
and that's
good.
And that's about it. I'm not very good at it.
An admission, online learning expert, not good at Facebook. Okay, John, hey, lots to talk about this week. I mean, I say that every week, and frankly, sometimes I'm lying, okay? But this week, I'm telling the truth because suddenly there were all these big education policy stories that broke, and we are going to talk about all of them. Ty, let's start by playing Pardon the Gadfly.
John, you're on Governor Romney's Education Advisory Committee. What did he propose this week?
Well, let me say, first of all, that it was good to see one of the two major presidential candidates actually have something to say about education. I think the great frustration in the campaign thus far, and this applies to the Republican primary campaign as well as the about to start general election campaign between the president and Governor Romney, the inattention and, in fact, the silence on education issues has been very frustrating on both sides. So it was very welcome news that Governor Romney was able to get out and give an address and release his points of view. There's a lot of emphasis on choice in the public statements, and that naturally is getting a great deal of attention. It tends to be an issue, even though the administration has come over to the choice side of things. I would say choice is still one of those wedge issues that tends to divide people, and so there's a lot of talk about what that means. Focus on other wedge issues like the DC scholarship program, which the governor is supporting. Nevertheless, I believe if you read the K-12 position paper from top to bottom, it's a very balanced program. It's a program that derives a lot of inspiration from the success of Massachusetts during the time he was governor and since in advancing education. And I think that there's a good balance between standards and accountability, more of a get tough regulatory approach, and then a free market choice based approach.
All right, so let's talk about that a little bit, John. So on the free market approach, it does appear to say that we're going to voucherize Title I dollars, special ed dollars, or at least allow states to do so if they want to take the federal dollars, make them more portable, perhaps combine it with a weighted student funding kind of model at the state level, backpack funding. If the state wants it and it's legal in that state to go to private schools, they would allow that to happen too. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Well, that's what it says. What one makes of the proposal depends on what you read into it, because the proposal in fact is not specific about the details. So the idea of backpack funding is a concept that's supported by people on different places on the political spectrum. I mean, if you really care about disadvantaged students getting the money that is due to them, you want to see it focused, and you want as much money targeted to them as possible. If you believe in charter schools, and again, the administration has been a strong supporter of charter schools, you want to be sure that every dollar that student is entitled to from the federal level on down moves with the student if they make that choice.
Right.
The language about private schools is hedged to depend on what state policies are in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, basically, if the state permits it, then the governor is saying that the federal government should permit that. That's really deferring to the states. And I would say that the other thing about the Romney proposal that I think is both wise and should not be divisive, I think makes sense as good policy based on experience, is greater reliance on the states to make decisions. I think both sides have recognized that there's limits to what Washington can do. The Obama administration's using waivers for that. The governor has his view.
Okay, good. Okay, topic number two.
On Tuesday, the Department of Education released the details of a new district-level Race to the Top competition, including the requirement that school boards and superintendents be held accountable for student achievement. Is this a promising reform or a dead end?
John, you've written a lot about governance. You wrote a paper for us on governance and online learning. We've still got these 14,000 school boards out there. Why not say to them, hey, we're going to hold teachers accountable. We want to hold principals accountable. Why not superintendents and school board members, too?
Well, the simple reason is that the school boards, like it or not, are democratically elected. And so their service to the community ultimately is going to depend on what the voters say, or if they're appointed, on whoever, you know, is elected the appointer. So here's what I think is potentially attractive in this, because I think at the end of the day, this Race to the Top proposal does not mean what it says. I think that, you know, in the end, transparency around performance is important. So at the district level, working your way up from the teacher, to the extent that we know which teachers are successful and which ones aren't, that's a good thing. To the extent that we know which principals are adding value and which ones aren't, that's a good thing. To the extent that we know which districts are adding value, performing better for the kids that they have than one might expect, that's a good thing. And the voters should know about that. The board should know about that. So if a district is underperforming, a board has every reason to look at the tenure of their superintendent and say, you know, we weren't sure which way to go with this person, but it's underperforming, so we're not going to rehire the superintendent, or the voters for that matter. If it's completely clear that the district has been underperforming during the leadership of a particular board, then let the voters throw them out. But that's where the accountability ends. This really has promise as a transparency measure. And that's great, but that's the end of it.
I think once you start getting further away from the classroom, it's very hard to draw a direct line between the behavior of school board members, let's say, and student achievement. And you'd have to be very smart about the metrics that you use. If you could do it, I mean, sure, that sounds like something worth pursuing. It's also is the case in Texas, for example, Texas State Superintendent, the commissioner, has the authority to fire school board members in any local Texas school district. So that's another form of accountability. You could say,
yeah,
look,
these
districts are entities of the state, and they can be removed from office if they're not doing their job. And so, you know, pushing on this conversation is probably a good thing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's a long history of no transparency in public education, and if the voters really knew that their district was, you know, gangbusters doing far better than expectations, that would be important. If they knew it was underperforming, that would be important. It could change election outcomes.
Okay, topic number three.
The New York Times recently published an exposé of alleged abuses of tax credit scholarship programs. Was this biased journalism, or should school choice advocates be concerned?
Or both?
I thought it was an attack piece. First of all, if a state wants to provide tuition tax credits, and they can be direct or indirect, so the direct ones say, you know, if you're sending your child to a private school, or you have expenses for your child in a public school, books, computers, or whatnot, we're going to give you a tax credit for that, and it goes directly to you for your child, fine. If the policies are going to be indirect, where you're getting a tax credit for contributing to a foundation that provides scholarships, those should be governed by rules. But it is a way to support private education. The rules should have some neutrality and objectivity about who is eligible. If the program is set up so that it is a so that it's essentially a device for you to fund your own private education, and it's done that way because tuition tax credits directly couldn't be passed, well, you know, there should be a crackdown on that. But the overall concept, if properly executed, is perfectly proper public policy. So
and you know, we have this example, and the piece thankfully did mention that Florida is an exemplar here. It's got a very well-run program, does not have these same issues, and has been designed quite tightly. And John Kirtley, who leads that program and funds it to a large degree, he's a big financier of school choice efforts, has been telling these other states in Georgia and Arizona and Pennsylvania that they are headed towards a disaster if they don't clean up the way their programs worked. And unfortunately, it may take this New York Times article for those other states to listen. That you know, just as in the charter school world, these design issues really make a difference. And you've got to have some mechanism of oversight and quality control, because there's going to be bad actors, and you've got to be on the guard to root them out before the New York Times does.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the point. This article wasn't written from the perspective of students need options because the public schools are not all terrific. Funding of providing parents choice of private schools is constitutional. Here's a mechanism for doing it. What's the right way to do it? This was sort of throwing out the mm-hmm. baby with the bathwater.
She was quite impressive that in this article she was able to get on issues including evolution, of course. Fracking was mentioned. Somehow she fit that in. What else? Gay rights? No, maybe not.
No, I think Trayvon Martin.
Trayvon Martin, that's right. Alec, yes. Alec, she hit many of the hot button issues. It was quite impressive.
Yeah, it strayed beyond the issue for sure.
Okay, all right. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Did you put any money into Facebook yourself?
No money into Facebook. Nope. I still don't see how it's worth as much as it is. I'm missing something there.
We all are, it seems like, and maybe it's not. Okay, so what you got for us?
We have a new study out by Here in Nisar at Apt Associates that examines the competitive effects of charter schools in Milwaukee on the academic performance of traditional public school students. We've seen similar studies like this before, mixed results, but this one's got a little twist.
By the way, I understand somebody in the room might have written a famous book on this topic.
Maybe.
Way back in the early 90s. Politics Markets.
Woo-hoo, that's right. Uh-huh. That was actually the one book that was assigned to me that I read from cover to cover in grad school.
Love it.
Yep.
Anyway.
That's what I always hear. It makes me feel old.
Okay.
I didn't know you were still alive. I've heard that.
Yes. Sorry, the fan club comes out. Yes. A class.
So he attempts to parse whether there's a difference in impact among charters run by MP Yes, and those run by other authorizers, namely the City of Milwaukee and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In case you don't know, funding in Milwaukee for charters is on a per-student basis, meaning money follows the child. So traditional schools are not insulated from losing money, so hopefully they're going to compete for kids in a better fashion than other places. Anyway, he uses as his measure of competition the entry and exit of charter schools within a half-mile radius of traditional school, attempts to control for student self-selection and ability, and the fact that charters locate in areas where students are not satisfied with their traditional school. Bottom line, he finds that non-district sponsored charter schools have a significant positive impact on students' math and reading achievement in the traditional school, but only in math is the effect statistically different from the impact of district sponsored schools. Do we get all that?
Whew. Okay. Whew. So wait, let's get this straight. So if there is a charter, an independent charter school in the neighborhood, those kids that stay at their traditional public school do better.
Right,
in math.
Different in math from the district sponsored.
Okay.
Right. A couple other little nuggets, which seems to make sense, right? Because the schools that are overseen by the district obviously aren't going to feel that much competition since the money's still staying within the district.
Yeah.
Second, he finds that the impact of non-district authorized charters is more pronounced for low achievers and black students in traditional schools, and that reiterates some previous research findings. So, that was a neat little study.
John, what's your take on this, but also the larger research on competitive effects these days? A lot of debate, and a lot of people saying, look, it's hard to find much in terms of competitive effects on districts, especially at the school level, because, you know, whose principal, is anybody's job, a principal's job, up for grabs if they have lower enrollment? I mean, it seems like the whole system doesn't work like that.
Yeah, I mean, my view of this kind of research is that there is still too much of an emphasis on trying to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Were there competitive effects or not? Was the school better for the kids or not? The charter school better or not? Thumbs up, thumbs down. And what you find is that the effects vary. And where the attention ought to be directed is to the conditions under which we find large effects and the conditions under which we find weak or even negative effects. Several years ago, the Stanford Center that's run by Mackie Raymond came out with a study that said one third of the charter schools in the U.S. are better, one third are about the same, and one third are worse than regular public schools. And opponents of choice seized on that as, oh, see, we told you they don't make a difference. But the second paragraph of the story, which was really important, was that, yeah, they do vary, but we understand the variation. In some places, like New York City, the effects were dramatically greater. And in other places, like Ohio, a badly run charter system, if I dare say so here.
Yes, absolutely.
The results have been poor, and where I think that the charter studies, the competition studies need to go are trying to identify the conditions that bring about better effects. That the evidence is the effects are there. We need to understand when they're really pronounced and when they're suppressed.
I mean, I'm intrigued by this, looking at the effects on individual schools. Because so let's say in Milwaukee, it looks like, okay, so there is an effect, it looks like, for individual schools when they've lost a lot of kids to a nearby charter school, independent charter school. I'm not sure why that is. I mean, unless Milwaukee has moved to a system whereby principals are incentivized in some way to try to win those kids back, or it matters to the, you know, do they get evaluated in part based on enrollment? I mean, otherwise, I would expect systemic effects at the district level, like the politics change, the unions say, oh my gosh, we're losing all these kids and losing members, and therefore we'll fight back. But why would it happen at the school level?
Well, that is the big question. What would cause a school to behave differently, positively? So to take the sort of the classic example, urban schools for decades have been subject to the flight of people from their schools to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. This is not causing them to get better. You would think that, they would rise up and rise to the occasion and improve their education so people wouldn't flee. But no, they keep following the same practices that provide for a crummy education, and they don't get any better. So in a charter situation, just because you're faced with competition, if the rules in the district don't change, you know, holding you accountable for outcomes, giving you flexibility to do that, then the competition is not going to cause all boats to rise.
You're losing money in Milwaukee.
Well, the individual schools aren't necessarily.
Why not?
Well, why are they? I mean, I don't know. Is it a weighted student funding system within Milwaukee public schools?
That was my understanding. I mean, at least from this particular item.
I mean, that's important to understand. To Mike's point, if the district is just losing money and the schools don't really feel it, then they're not going to change.
You know, but does, when people start talking about principal evaluations as a part of the teacher evaluation system, I do think this is one thing we should be encouraging, is that enrollment should be something principals, that matter to principals. Yeah, if you are losing enrollment, that should be something you don't, you know, that's not a positive thing. To create some more incentives for these principals to pay attention to their customers.
I mean, that's exactly it. If you were the principal of a charter school and you were losing enrollment, you would feel it intensely, because there are no other dollars. There's no other place to go and ask for money. All the things that you want to do for kids, now you can't do because you've lost enrollment. You have to focus on it.
Yeah.
You know, it really is like a business. If you lose customers, you know, it can be death. In traditional public schools, the incentives just aren't set up that way, but they could.
That's right.
All right. Well, that's great. Hey, this was really fun, John, to get to talk about competitive effects with the John Chubb. Next time we'll have Terry on too, and it can be a big reunion. All right. That is all the time we have for this week. Until next week.
This is John Chubb.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.